Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We currently have a bonus episode on Dune Part 2, another one coming soon about the new FX miniseries Shogun. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Keith Phipps.
Tasha is once again out for a third straight pairing, but rest assured she'll emerge soon from the clutches of a sadistic crime boss $2 million richer. In the meantime, we're extremely excited to have an old friend and colleague, Emily St. James, filling in for her today. Emily was the TV editor with us at the AV Club back in the day, and would go on to be a culture editor and writer at Vox. She has since shifted into a range of other exciting projects, including the Arden podcast and a writing gig on the hit Showtime series Yellow Jackets. She has also collaborated with another old friend and colleague of ours, Noel Murray, on an upcoming book about the TV show Lost called Lost, Back to the Island. Emily, welcome.
Hi, it's really good to be here. I'm so happy to be back. I loved when I did the show before, and I'm also glad I got to discuss my favorite subject, lesbians. I have to say, any movie that has lesbians in it is at least a little bit good, so I was glad to get this week's pairing.
Any movie? There's got to be exceptions.
Any movie where, like, one of the protagonists is a lesbian, I'm like, usually like, yeah, you know, there's some that are dodgy, but I'm still like, there was a lesbian, and I liked that about it.
Pretty good batting average, I think. I'm trying to think of lesbian cinema, solid batting average.
Yes.
So this early part of 2024 has brought us a trendlet of sorts in lesbian neo-noirs. On our last show, we talked about Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook's long-in-the-making crime comedy Driveway Dolls, and now we have another film about women whose feelings for each other are stifled by their entanglement in the criminal underworld. Genevieve, want to talk about this week's pairing?
Sure. In Rose Glass's new film, Love Lies Bleeding, Kristen Stewart plays Lou, the lesbian manager of a downscale gym in the American Southwest in the 1980s. Her dead-end life changes when Jackie, a drifter and bodybuilder played by Katie O'Brien, sweeps through town and quickly becomes a priority. Their relationship flourishes, but in order for the two women to have a future together, they have to get out from under Lou's criminal family, led by a gun-smuggling Ed Harris. The authentic passion between Lou and Jackie, as well as their issues of trust, calls to mind the sapphic relationship at the center of the Wachowskis' 1996 debut feature, Bound. In Bound, as in Love Lies Bleeding, an instant spark is established between strangers played by Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon, which leads to a scheme to skip town with $2 million in laundered cash from Tilly's mob-connected live-in partner, played by Joe Pantoliano. Can they trust each other enough to rip off a dangerous men and live happily ever after? Stay tuned.
So this week, we'll revisit the Wachowskis' Bound and consider how it expands the boundaries of the noir genre. Then, in the next episode, we'll see how Love Lies Bleeding keeps pushing it in bold and unexpected new directions. Please stay with us.
She's making an offer.
It's a Caesar's Mafia, huh?
I need your help, Corky.
Only a fool would refuse.
It's over $2 million.
Because all money...
Oh, my God.
Look at this shirt. It's ruined.
...is good money.
You're asking me to help you fuck over the mob.
I'm going to ask you 10 times.
I want out.
Just admit it.
What? You lost it.
Where's my money?
If their plan succeeds...
Oh, God.
If they survive...
Sweet Jesus.
If they can trust each other...
I guess it was a job. Maybe the Carpellas. All part of the business.
They are bound.
I think I'm a dead man. I'm one in the back of the head.
For the pleasure.
You were nothing before you met me. Violet! You were nothing. You had nothing.
For the money.
I want what's mine. I want half the money.
For each other.
What did she do to you?
Everything you could.
When the Wachowskis' debut feature Bound came out in 1996, it was hard not to lump it in with the sexy thrillers that had become a cottage industry since Paul Verhoeven's Basic Instinct was a sensation 4 years earlier. Since Basic Instinct, Hollywood had been trying to recapture that same kinky magic with sultry actresses like Madonna in Body of Evidence, Deborah Kara Unger in Whispers in the Dark, and Sharon Stone again in Sliver. And that's to say nothing of the lucrative straight-to-video offerings of Shannon Tweed, who would put out movies with titles like Indecent Behavior in the hopes that it might fool people into thinking they're renting something classier. Whatever the case, you could see Bound at first glance as a cheap exploitation movie, a rote, violent mob thriller constructed around lipstick lesbians. After all, one of its stars, Gina Gershon, had worked a similar beat the year before in Verhoeven's widely reviled Showgirls. And yet, at a minimum, people should have noticed, as many did at the time, that Bound is exceptionally well-crafted, drawing comparisons to the stylized violence of Coen Brothers movies like Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing. But the film was embraced by gay and lesbian film festivals at the time, and has since become a benchmark for queer cinema, demonstrating not just the Wachowskis' impeccable craft, but themes of gender and sexual fluidity that would continue throughout their careers and their personal lives. A lesbian relationship that once seemed like the hook for a showy modern noir now seems like the inverse. A showy noir that traffics in a substantive, empowering, and steamy look at two women trying to negotiate their way through a man's world. The title Bound has multiple meanings, but it's about liberation, about these femmes fatales being unbound to anything but each other. Made with great economy and style for $6 million, Bound takes place mostly in adjoining spaces in an apartment building, connected by walls as thin as those in Rosemary's Baby. Gina Gershon plays Corky, an ex-con who's taken a job refurbishing an empty mob-owned apartment. The fact that she's an ex-con is part of how she got the gig, because she would be inclined to talk about whatever she sees or hears in the building. On an elevator ride up, Corky locks eyes with the glamorous Violet, played by Jennifer Tilly. Violet lives with Caesar, played by Joe Pantoliano, a short-tempered money launderer, but she occasionally takes work selling her body, suggesting the path that led to her current life. Though Corky is marked as the more masculine of the two, a handy woman who swills beer and wears men's briefs, it's Violet who initiates their affair and eventually brings Corky into a scheme to set them both free. As a professional thief, Corky does the planning on a job to boost $2 million in laundered money away from the mob and have the theft pinned on Caesar, though things don't go according to script. It should be said that even as a genre exercise, Bound is notably assured for a debut feature, or any feature for that matter, with a lot of the suspense owed to Pantoliano's Caesar, who's much smarter than Corky and Violet assume him to be, and thus a much greater foe. But as smooth as the genre mechanics are, what this suspense machine is really engineering is a personal, progressive love story that holds the entire period of mid-90s sexy thrillers in sharp relief. The Wachowskis brought in the feminist Susie Bright as a sex consultant on the film, which now seems like a precursor to the intimacy coordinators that have become part of many productions. But Bright's creative role in emphasizing certain aspects of the sex scenes, like the use of hands and water as a motif, put them above other sequences of their kind. Beyond that, there's something genuinely touching about Violet and Corky's relationship, a shared desire and perhaps a desperation to carve out a new life together, despite the fact that their relationship is still new and that they may not be able to trust each other. The Wachowskis don't make them femme fatales, but merely femmes, teasing the audience with their black leather allure and criminal designs, only to have them searching, in earnest, for the exit door. There's a surreptitious phone exchange between the two in the middle of the job, when things have gotten messy and violent and uncertain, and either of them could just run away. "Corky," says Violet, "I want to tell you something." "I know, Violet," says Corky, "I know. It's why I'm still here." We'll talk more about this heartwarming movie after the break.
I had to see you.
Look, I don't think this is a good idea.
I wanted to apologize.
Please, don't apologize. There's one thing I can't stand is women who apologize for wanting sex.
I'm not apologizing for what I did. I'm apologizing for what I didn't do.
So we haven't opened with this question in a while, but I think it's relevant here because I saw Bound in 1996. And as I said in the keynote, it came out in a certain context, I should say. So I'm kind of curious when you all first saw Bound and whether your understanding of the film has sort of changed over time.
I saw it in 96 in the theaters. And yeah, I kind of liked what you touched on about how just sort of without the film changing, our perception of it has changed a lot over the years. But I saw it, I liked it a lot. And I thought, wow, what an exciting debut from a new set of independent filmmakers. I'm looking forward to lots of indie films in this vein from these two. And then, of course, next is The Matrix.
I remember that like they were sort of either going to make The Matrix or this like cannibal slasher low budget thing. And I, you know, I do dearly wish that they would get back together and make the cannibal slasher thing. But I first saw Bound probably in 97, 98 on home video because I did not live in a place where we had a theater that would play Bound. And it was with a bunch of teenage boys who at the time thought I was a teenage boy for some reason. And it was, I could feel that like just the delight seeping out of the room because they were like, this movie's just going to be like tits all the time. It's just going to be like women smashing their breasts against windows and like rubbing them back and forth. And it was not that. It was like a movie with a plot. And yes, there's nudity, but it's not particularly like aimed at the male gaze. It's in a really like way that's fascinating that should have probably told some people some things. And my relationship to it has changed over the years for a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Had you revisited it before this podcast?
I think I revisited it a couple of years ago. I went through the Wachowskis movies for some other project. I went through as many of them as I could. And this was one I hadn't revisited. And I was even more taken with it. Like I had liked it back then. I was hyped for The Matrix because of Bound. But I certainly, a couple of years ago, when I understood myself as trans and the filmmakers as trans, was more able to like lock into the ways that this movie is about love and sexuality and gendered performance through a very trans lens, even though I guess the Wachowskis and myself at the time would not have called themselves trans. Like there is that element is so baked into it in a way that's very similar to how people's feelings on The Matrix have changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess here's where I'll barge in and embarrass myself and say, this is my first time seeing Bound, everyone.
Yay.
How did it change over time for you between when you saw it and right now?
Well, I mean, I think I can at least speak to sort of just what my perception of it was before seeing it versus after seeing it. Because, I mean, obviously, it's a film I knew about. It's definitely one on the regrettably long list of films that I knew I should see and just never got around to. Because, you know, when TV is your job, movies unfortunately take a little bit of a sideline, as I think Emily can probably attest as well.
Yes, for so long. Yes.
So I'm thrilled that I finally like got the chance to fill in that blank. But earlier, like when I first knew about Bound, I knew about it like in the context that you probably watched it in when you were 13, Emily, like sexy lesbian movie, you know, and didn't really have any sort of awareness or context of the fact that like it's a crime story, you know, like it's a love story, but it's also arguably even more so a crime story. And then kind of as I got older and learned more about film and saw more movies, it became a Wachowskis movie. And then it became like even more of sort of a shame that I hadn't seen it yet. So all of which is to say, like, it had kind of like been built up in my mind a lot going into this. And it felt like I think I had like built it up as like a really important movie that I hadn't seen. And I had to like, you know, really take it seriously. But after watching, it's like, oh, this is just like a crackerjack, really fun movie in a lot of ways. You know, it's a ripping yarn. And yeah, I mean, there's some hot sex in it and there's some gory violence in it. Nothing I couldn't handle. Thank you very much. but
I thought the whole finger thing was not good, though, that you didn't like the finger deal.
You know, I'm not saying I didn't cover my eyes a couple times, but, you know, I didn't have to like get up and leave the room. But yeah, it was just like, I was, I guess, more entertained by it, like just pure entertainment value than I had kind of expected going into it with maybe more of a intellectualized, cerebral mindset. So I'm really glad that I had that experience.
I think like it's fascinating the way that the cultural perception of this movie has also changed. Not as much as The Matrix, but in a similar way to The Matrix, where queer people, queer scholars, queer film scholars latched onto this movie in The Matrix long before the Wachowskis were out. And we're always sort of like, you know, movies made about lesbians by non-lesbians are almost always bad, except for Bound. And like, you know, it is this thing of like the Wachowskis always sort of got this pass when the world did not perceive them as two queer women. And then the world was like, oh, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, again, it's all sort of in my keynote about the sort of the context in which this film was released at the time. But part of me at the time, too, was thinking like, this is just a tryout film. This is two filmmakers doing their twist on kind of a this sort of a kinkier twist on a stock noir and injecting a tremendous amount of style and craft in it. And that will get them to make the next thing, which ended up being The Matrix. Obviously, you know, revisiting the film since I was kind of knocked out by it. I did it for New Cult Canon. I think it was when I revisited it and obviously had a bigger impression on me then. And then seeing it again today in light of everything, it's just, you know, in light of their careers and the way things have gone, it's such a different, it hits different as the kids might say.
Yeah. It's not an audition film in many ways, and it's not part of the post Tarantino.
Coen's especially, you know.
But it's also its own thing, and in a really interesting in a way too. I had not seen it since 1996, so it was cool to go back to it. I'd also forgotten how claustrophobic and set bound it was, but it also makes it work for it too. You know, it works in the favor, or works in the film's favor. That is. Yeah, I thought it held up really well. I will say, not the most convincing Chicago.
Yeah.
It was, you know, when you do see the streets, it's like, that's not Chicago.
Like, you don't need shots, though, of the Chicago skyline when, like, Joe Pantoliano's Chicago accent is the Chicago skyline.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And I believe those cops as Chicago cops, too. Just kind of walking in and doing nothing, really wanting to accept a beer, but they can't.
it is interesting, like, how, you know, when I think about the movie, how little of it, it just feels like it's just the two apartments. I mean, I know there's more in the movie, and you do get a scene in Corky's
that elevator
apartment.
Don't forget that elevator.
Yeah, and the elevator's still there, but it really does a fine job of like, okay, we've got a limited amount of money. How do we make that work? And how do we make it work in a way that's going to kind of sort of pop stylistically? And so there's a huge amount of, you know, energy devoted to this location, this floor of the apartment building where you have these two, you know, adjoining apartments connected by this really thin wall. And it's just like, it's all you really need. And it's another thing that connects Bound with a film like Blood Simple, because there's that famous scene in Blood Simple where there are two people on separate sides of a wall. And, you know, you could get the shot where someone's just randomly shooting through the wall and you get the shafts of light going in. And anyway, you know, it feels like an audition film in that respect. And it's got those sort of Barry Sonnenfeld-esque camera moves where you're kind of like moving through a piano wire and in and out of, you know, spaces and stuff. But,
even that like opening shot in the closet where you're like kind of turning on a weird axis and it's not like you don't really know which way is up until the camera kind of resolves. It's a really cool opening scene and didn't not make me think about The Matrix in terms of camera work.
Yeah, you can see a lot of what's coming now when you watch it, but it was not none of that was clear. I mean, The Matrix is not to sidetrack us too much, but like it's such a out of nowhere thing. I mean, obviously it synthesizes so many different influences, but like who saw that coming? It's just one of those turning point movies in some ways.
I think one of the things that has made the Wachowskis successful that you can see in this film and especially in The Matrix is they wear their influences on their sleeves, but the influences are not the sort of influences you'd see anywhere else. They're blended together in sort of a new way, and their perspective is different on those influences. You know, like this movie is interested in being in conversation with Coen Brothers movies, with noir movies, with this entire genre it's part of. But the simple fact of being like, this is going to be about two women and it's also going to be their love story, like immediately flips the perspective that this story is usually told from in a way that becomes really refreshing and exciting. And, you know, they're still getting to do all the like cool camera moves and all of the like, you know, shadowy figures and mob bosses sitting in your easy chair or whatever. But like, it's very much like, because you're seeing it through the perspective of two women and it's largely told through their point of view, like there's an exciting newness to it, even though you've seen everything in it before.
Yeah, which kind of brings me to this question, which is, you know, this is a, you know, a neo-noir and is a film that plays with that genre. I mean, to what extent does it play by those rules and where does it stand out? Where does it kind of like separate itself from other films of this genre?
Well, I mean, you have an obvious femme fatale in Violet who's actually not a femme fatale at all. She's actually pretty sincere and sweet and she doesn't manipulate Corky into crime, but it is convenient. It's like, you know, as long as you're here, maybe we should talk about this. It's you never get the feeling that she has a hidden agenda with Corky, but she is definitely cut from the same cloth as femme fatales in other ways.
I mean, the obvious thing this movie has that most noirs don't is lesbians. And like, that's like, I mean, I'm making a joke, but it is like not wrong because there are noirs with great love stories. There are noirs with romances. Usually they end badly. This movie kind of has to end with them together for it to work, which I think is fascinating. So it has to simultaneously balance the noir with a genuine, like moving romance. And those two tones shouldn't work together as well as they do. And yet, you know, you watch this movie and you really do want them to drive off into the sunset, even though you're aware of the genre expectations. And I think I've been thinking a lot about how for most of Hollywood's history, when we've been making overt queer films, it's been easier to get films made about lesbians than gay men because lesbians are assumed to be titillating to the sorts of people who are greenlighting these movies. But what that means is you can make a lot of movies about lesbians in other genres, but then there's also sort of this like weird expectation of, well, they're going to be together at the end. Whereas if you just tell a straight story, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is one of my favorite movies of all time, but the expectation of that film is that they can't be together at the end. But in Bound, you're like, well, of course, even though they exist in a genre where they, by all rights, one of them should die, they're both going to be together and alive and in love at the end, right? And then they are, and it's great.
Yeah, Guinevere Turner has an essay that you can, it's kind of awkward, you can read it as a bonus feature on the Blu-ray of this from the late limited Olive Films, but she talks about how much the end of the film, like she kind of dreaded the end because she thought something's going to happen, you know, and it's like, it's, you know, I've seen Thelma and Louise, these two people getting in a car together, it's not going to end well. And then like, you know, it made me think about how consciously it seemed to be evoking the end of Thelma and Louise, like from the sunglasses on to the hand holding and everything like that, but they drive off. They're good. You know, it's a kind of like a last little bit of subversion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's, I think one of the things that I find fascinating about the idea of the lesbian love story in another genre is I think that like the people who greenlight these movies are often like, well, of course, if we could exist in a world without men, that would be wonderful, right? And they're like often men. So it's sort of like, you know, Thelma and Louise can't escape their genre trappings because they're straight, but like Violet and Corky can because they're gay. And it's like this weird baked in assumption in our culture that animates so many of our films and TV shows, which I find, I don't know where that comes from. I'm always thinking about it.
One of the things I like about the fact that they kind of emerge together is that it raises the stakes of the actual scheme. I mean, for one, In a noir film, people fall in love very quickly, you know, or lust or something. There's something very powerful that leads them to, you know, as a femme fatale, you're sort of drawn into that person's web and you can't trust them, but you can't help yourself. And you pay in the end for that. And here it's also very quick and lusty. And there is that element of that trust question is still out there. But what is so touching about the movie is that as the scheme unravels, really, you know, as things don't go as planned, and as they're on separate sides of the wall, and they're trying to figure out what to do in the situation, Corky in particular has a chance to just leave. I mean, there's just no, she can just go, and she doesn't, you know. And there's that scene I sort of quoted in the keynote where it's like where you know, Violet, you know, wants to say I love you, and Corky knows that's what she wants to say, and it's while she says it's why I'm still here. And I think that's such a nice note for, you know, in a genre that, you know, where things tend to not end terribly well for our heroes.
Yeah. You know, I think another thing that sets this movie apart is This is not as huge a break. The various gangster bad guy characters are not particularly original, but the way that they're cast, the actors who are playing them, that gives them a chance to feel less like heavies and more like very clever people who are always thinking a little bit ahead. And I think that that gives this movie an added amount of juice because they can't go all out on like gun battles or anything like that because of the limited budget. So it really has to be, it has to have that Hitchcock element of like smart people trying to sort of outthink each other in the middle of a terrible game that none of them quite understand the rules of. And I really like that aspect of it this time around.
I think it's interesting to note that like there's like a baseline criminality associated with every character, you know, like Corky's an ex-con. I'm not going to like say that they are quote unquote criminals, but they have all they are familiar with a life of crime. You know, they are all coming to this story having an association with crime in some way or another. So that like absolves any sort of sense of their being innocents and heavies, as you say, Emily. And it just allows for a lot more sort of kind of shading to the quote unquote wrongdoing or just the scheming. And so it's kind of like when everyone's a criminal, then there's like the good criminals and the bad criminals. And it just makes it, I think, a little more interesting than a simple binary of like the innocent and the wrongdoer.
Yeah.
It's kind of insinuated that like this whole apartment, you know, building is just sort of its own little criminal enterprise. Like the guy who owns it hires ex-cons, and obviously Caesar kind of knows the deal and presumably it lives there because of that looking the other way, you know. So it kind of like creates this little bubble of criminality in which this story can play out.
It does kind of feel like it takes place in the John Wick universe where like everybody is a criminal.
Yes. You know? Yes.
Yeah. And I think that Caesar is kind of a nuanced character. I don't think there's, because there's, he's not like Johnny. He's not the typical sort of bloodthirsty gangster. I mean, he is short tempered and he can be violent, but there's an intelligence there and there's a real relationship that I think that he has with Violet that is not so cut and dry, that it has some complexity and some interesting tensions to it. It's just like it's a character that could so easily be stock and isn't at all. And again, it kind of, you know, raises the stakes of that of the end of the scheme itself, because it's a tough break for him. He's kind of, you know, he's the one who's going to get pinned for all of this stuff. And there are worse gangsters out there.
He works so hard cleaning that money. He starched it. I've never starched anything in my life. And he did it like hundreds, if not thousands of times. And
he also reveals himself as a violent creep who has, you know, who's not nice to Violet, but it takes a while. He doesn't seem like that bad of a boyfriend. If you're going to have a mobbed up boyfriend of convenience, you could do worse than Caesar until he gets, you know, he takes a turn.
Yeah. What I think is interesting about Caesar and Violet's relationship is the way that you realize it's not entirely real is almost nothing to do with him and everything to do with her. She like performs a character in a weird way with a higher, she plays a normal Jennifer Tilly character in some ways and with like a higher pitched voice when she's talking to Caesar. Then when she's talking to Corky, it's a little bit more real. She's a little bit more of a person. And you sort of get the sense that like, Caesar knows this is a little bit of a performance, but doesn't want to look past that because it's a performance that like suits him and serves him. Mm-hmm. And so like when he's revealed as a violent creep, it doesn't come out of nowhere. And some of that's because of the genre you're in, but some of it is also like, he doesn't actually want to accept her as a person. He wants to accept her as a performance. And that's like that's why queer people were very into this movie, but even before the Wachowskis came out, because it's a very nuanced understanding of, you know, what it is to operate in the world as a bisexual woman.
So I wanted to get into that, the central relationship here and the kind of romantic chemistry between Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon. What did you make of it and how it's kind of established? Obviously it worked for you, but I'm curious how it works for you, how the film sort of sells us on these two characters and these two actresses together.
I think the chemistry is so strong.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could be, it's just, there's a hotness there, you know, could be two women, could be two men, could be a man and a woman. It's just that when the chemistry's there, it's there. And it's just very apparent from the beginning here.
I mean, yeah, like just from the very first scene, I mentioned the elevator, that red elevator, the first look they share, like literally behind Caesar's back, you know, oblivious, but just in this like deep red, such an intense setting that I think complements the very intense look and connection between them. And that is all like down to chemistry between the actresses, that they're able to give you all this in literally seconds of film, you know? And certainly the framing and the setting of it doesn't hurt at all, but it really comes down to that look, and they sell it from the very beginning. And from there, I think it's just inevitable, you know where this is going, because where else could it go after that look?
The sex is very good also. Like when it gets to the sex, it's very well done, and it's not framed. Again, it's titillating, but not in the way you sort of expect it to be from like other films about lesbians that were popular at this time. You know, it's there is a care to the way that they have sex with each other that is so evident. There's a tenderness to it. And I think, not to spoil our talk about the next film, but like you see that in Love Lies Bleeding as well. Even when they start to curdle that later in that film, this movie like is very interested in the ways that Corky is able to care for Violet that she hasn't been cared for by Caesar. And that sort of transmutes into the sex scenes in a way that is very well done and like sort of makes you more invested in them as a couple. And also it's just hot, you know.
And they have good pillow talk. I don't even know if it really counts as pillow talk, but you know, saying I can see again, you know, post, yeah. like post-coital, like, I mean, that sells it, I think, you know, but
it's very much in the tradition of like lesbian pulp novels. And it where, you know, the woman and the woman come together, and then at the end of the pulp novels, they almost always died, and Bound is smart enough to like let them out of that trap. But it's very much like, yes, I've met a woman and I've kissed her, and now I can see again. It's wonderful.
And the device, I think the device with the earring down the sink is really great. That whole sequence is wonderful too. A wonderful sort of follow up. Things just escalate so perfectly in the film to where you kind of just believe that these steps, you know, you believe kind of step by step where this relationship lands. And I think it's a hard thing for a movie to do because these two are taking incredible risks for each other. They have to trust each other, and they haven't known each other for very long, and they both have colorful histories, and there's a lot of money at stake, and you know, so the film has to, you know, make you believe them every step of the way, both their attraction to each other and their ability to feel something deeper and follow through on that feeling. I think it's pretty impressive, and it's the casting part of it is big. It's one of those things where, well, I mean, you throw a couple other actresses in the movie, or one other, you swap one out for another. It's like you don't even want to imagine it because it seems
because Tilly was supposed to be Corky originally, right? If I did my background, but she, after I guess, like, even she realized that Gina Gershon was better suited to it.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about that scene where Violet kind of finally makes her intentions clear by standing in front of Corky and like sort of rubbing her breast and like being like, you know, just like showing herself to Corky. And that is the one scene in the movie that could just go very south if it wasn't handled with great care by the actors. And like, I can't imagine it without Jennifer Tilly. Like, so many actors would like put too heavy a spin on it. And there's always something playful about Tilly that makes that moment work when it maybe shouldn't.
Yes, for sure. So, I was curious, I guess this maybe as a question I can start with you here, Emily, but because you said you did a bit of a dive into the Wachowskis' work, you know, in recent years. I mean, how do you feel that Bound sort of fits into the themes that I guess they would explore, you know, later in their career?
Yeah, I think this movie is very interested in, I want to sort of back up and like take this in the perspective of the question we were just talking about, which is every time I watch this, I'm going to use some fancy screenwriting terms. I assume that like the hookup, the sex scene is the midpoint of the film, like the thing where the climax and everything goes in both directions from that. And it's actually kind of like the end of Act One. It's much earlier than I remember every time. And I think that is indicative of what the Wachowskis have always been interested in, which is, yes, they love the movies. They love the power that a good movie storytelling can have, but they're always interested in like how you can transcend that, like how you can transcend the story you're trapped in, how you can transcend the world you're trapped in, how you can transcend your own body, your own form. And like, Bound is very interested in like escape and this idea of like, we are trapped in a tiny bubble and we need to get out of it. In some ways, it's a perfect microcosm of where the Matrix goes, just with a much larger budget. But I also think it's like its portrayal of this relationship between two women is gendered in a way that makes sense through a trans lens. And I'm not sure makes sense otherwise. Like, obviously, but like there is a performative way that both Violet and Corky approach femininity that is like very much that of, you know, sort of two trans women trying to understand like what feminine performance is before they've like grappled with that in themselves, which is like a journey I've been through. And it's a very difficult and weird one to go through, but like the heightened gendered performance of both Violet and Corky then sort of softens across the film. Like as they find themselves in each other, they're able to sort of find themselves, you know, independently. And finally, the Wachowskis are just constantly saying that if you just find the right person to love, you can transcend all of time and space. And like, it's right there in this first movie. So it feels like this movie is very interested in the idea of transcending everything and the idea of having a body that you have, you're sort of expected to use in a certain way. And in just the idea of like a great love story overcoming all.
I think that's perfect.
It really is. It's like, what else am I supposed to add to that? I have no idea. That's really good.
Like, I like hearing you put it that way, just in the context of this, like how claustrophobic this film feels. And, you know, obviously it's called Bound, and, you know, like the feeling of being, you know, trapped or confined is, you know, sort of one of its motivating themes. But I guess I hadn't really put it into the realm of like transcendence, like transcending that space as sort of a motivating interest as well. But like, it does like notably end with them leaving this place that the whole story takes place in, you know, escaping the Matrix, if you will. So yeah, that's very well put.
I was just going to say that they are also bound together at the end of the film, so they're not completely.
So there's
a nice little a happy meaning to the word at a certain point.
And I think you hear bound in the context of a movie that's supposed to be very sexy, and you don't think about it as like bound by the ties of love. You're like, mm-hmm. Well, this is going to have some S&M in it, isn't it? And it really doesn't. But like, I do think like my favorite Wachowski movie, which I always preface by saying it is the best movie ever made, except for the moments in which it's the worst movie ever made, and that is Cloud Atlas.
I know exactly what
like,
this is.
You're just like going along, and then it's like, we're going to make an incredibly disastrous creative choice. How do you feel about this? And I'm like, I'm not sure. And then they were like, well, we're now going to do something else. But like, Bound in almost every way feels like it could be one of the vignettes in Cloud Atlas without too much trimming, without too much cutting. And I love that aspect of it. It's very dedicated to the genre it exists in, while also being like, how do we break out of the confines of this genre?
Not to sidetrack us, but it's been a while. What are the disastrous parts of Cloud Atlas?
Well, the Wachowskis decided that, so basically the actors recur across all six of the stories.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, and so the Wachowskis decided to do some yellow face, which was maybe not the world's best idea. And at the time, they were sort of like, well, we're having the actors of color, you know, just take on white characteristics. And it was just like, you know, it kind of doesn't work that way. But I like it because the movie is so bleeding heart on its sleeve. But anytime somebody tells me they hate that movie, I'm like, yeah, I get it.
I like it too, and I also like it, and you can relate to this, because it was the first time I had, after I had a kid, where I had 3 hours I didn't have to do anything.
Oh yeah. You know,
3 hours straight. It's like, thank you, movie, for being so long. I can just sit here.
I will always remember Avatar: The Way of Water. I got to leave my house.
I guess you know, the other to continue with this, I mentioned Susie Bright, of course, played a role in the choreography of the sex scenes and the sexual imagery. There's a lot of that, double entendres, et cetera. It's a very, you know, if you're going to see a sexy thriller, it does sort of deliver the goods. But how does the sex of the film sort of play for you, and what sets it apart from other films of the time? I think we got into it a little bit, but maybe we should do it a little bit more.
Well, I'm the co-host of a different podcast called Podcast Like It's, and right now we're going through the films of 1992, and we recently watched Louis Malle, I believe, film Damage. From 1992,
Julia Binoche and
Jeremy Irons. They're having a disastrous affair. She's his future daughter-in-law. And the sex scenes in that movie, which at the time were written about as though they were just incredibly hot, are so disastrously funny that they tank the film. What you really need to do is go find them on YouTube. But like, there is a scene where Binoche and Jeremy Irons are sitting and facing each other, both naked, and then they start like rocking back and forth like they're puppets and like closing in on each other. And it's so strange. And the sex in this movie feels real. And it's not like there was never a movie before this where the sex didn't feel real. Obviously there is, but the sex in this movie feels real and it feels intimate. And I think that that is because they had Bright there. Like, I think intimacy coordinators, for as much as some folks complain about them, are very helpful to establishing a situation where everybody sort of, I mean, ideally they establish a situation where everyone feels safe without like hampering the creative intents of the filmmaker. But like, I also think they establish a situation that is like, maybe you don't know a lot about like what this situation would be like. And this person can just sort of like get into that. There's like, I hate to be like, this film is knowledgeable and that's good. But like, this film is knowledgeable. It like knows what it's doing and what it's trying to do and like how to present this on camera in a way that's thoughtful. And that is why the sex is not embarrassing in the way that so many movies around this time were.
Yeah, and I would say that this was something Genevieve mentioned earlier with the kind of the post-coital conversation. I mean, you also have, you know, things like you know, Gina Gershon's character sort of like, you know, washing her hands and then just kind of like, you know, re-examining them. And it's just, it just kind of makes that sort of connection, that little sort of memory of what had happened. And then all the stuff with the, you know, when she's, the suggestiveness of the water and the pipe and everything like that. It's just like there are ways that you could sort of offhand, non-explicit ways that sort of trigger the imagination that the film embraces as well. In addition to being as explicit as it needs to be, as you might expect it to be.
I think there's a thing that's fascinating in this movie, which is that when you have stories about lesbians, often there are a lot of like jokes about fingers. And this movie has a villain who likes to cut off people's fingers and explicitly threatens like Violet's fingers at one point. And yet I didn't think about that. I was not,
I didn't
like,
either.
You know, it is just like a part of the tapestry of this film. They don't hang a lantern on it. And it just is like, you know, so many other, it's a thing that could have been disastrous if this movie didn't have a sense of being lived in. And fortunately it does.
I didn't put that together necessarily in relation to the cutting off of fingers, but I did kind of make a little like connection in my brain just between like Corky being a plumber and using her hands in various ways. And, you know, we already kind of talked about the, you know, film's water imagery, and it also, of course, plays into that. But it's definitely there in the finger cutting as well.
Yeah. And she's another neat thing is she's very mask, but in a way that is not like overpowering, in a way that is not that other movie. Yeah. They don't feel the need to underline it so much that you feel like you're missing what they're doing. They trust their actor to be able to get to that.
We'll get to that other movie in relationship to Bound later when we talk about Love Lies Bleeding next week. But for now, we'll step out and come back for feedback. Now it's time for feedback, but before we get to it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's Mothership podcast hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. On the most recent episode, as we record here, Adam and Josh spent a very, very long time unpacking Dune Part 2, first in a spoiler light review segment and later in a spoiler filled deep dive for those who have seen it. So drink deep from that water of life. As for feedback, we're going to table that for another episode because we have Emily on here, and we're eager to learn more about The Lost Book, which comes out September 17th. Emily.
Wait, she lost her book?
What's this?
No, I'm kidding.
Nothing. Oh, I'm just making a joke about the lost book. That's a Scott Tobias joke. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you threw me. You threw me. Emily, I know you and Noel have had this book in the works for quite some time. You got the advance, sat around for, you know, you waited a little bit, then you wrote it. So how did it come together, and what can readers expect?
Noel and I wrote my last book, Monsters of the Week, which is an X-Files book. I wrote that with Zach Hanlon, another former AV clubber. And I was looking for another show to cover, and Lost to me just felt like the obvious next choice. And so I reached out to Noel because for someone who's written a novel, I hate writing on my own. I hate it. It just it feels so lonely to me. I love writing with a co-author. So I reached out to Noel. I was like, listen, you love Lost. I love Lost. Let's write a book about it. And we took the pitch out and we sold it to Abrams Books. And that was February 2020, which was a time when selling a book was a great idea. And it was, we knew it was going to come out in September 2024 for the anniversary, because it's Lost is 20 years old this year. Don't think about that too hard. And we were like, well, we have 4 years to get this done. What could possossibly go wrong? Anyway, March 2020 came and everything fell apart. The world was not a great place to be. But one thing we noticed was how many people were watching Lost to get through those long months that we were all inside, how much Lost had remained in the culture. And we also were sort of interested in the ways that the legacy of Lost has become complicated by not just stories from the set, but stories from behind the scenes. Some of those have been recounted in other books like Maureen Ryan's Burn It Down, and others are just like, you know, the stars have gone on podcasts and been like, this is how I was treated. I didn't like it. And so we wanted to write about the show and write a critical appreciation of it. We review every episode. We write essays about different topics of interest. But we also wanted to acknowledge the fact that watching this show now is a little bit more complicated. And I think to myself, I think of it as an interesting examination of, you know, how our relationship to art changes across time, because the me that watched Lost in the last few years is very different from the me that watched Lost in the 2000s, but I still loved it and I still had a wonderful time. And I think if you are a huge fan of this show, you're going to find so much to love in this book. And I also think if you're someone who's a bit skeptical of the show, you're going to find a lot to engage with too. I think if you are planning a Lost rewatch, or if you're planning a first time watch, I think it's going to be a great companion to that. And also the cover is gorgeous. I had nothing to do with it. Somebody else designed that cover, but it's so gorgeous. It's beautiful. It looks like a travel poster for the island from the show. So I'm really excited for people to get to see it.
One thing I'm curious about, talking about sort of the, you know, how you engage with the changing context of watching it sort of on an individual level, do you two talk at all about sort of how we talk about TV has changed in the ensuing two decades? Because
Absolutely. Just
thinking back to Lost Mania when it was happening versus how people freak out about shows now, it couldn't happen again like that.
Absolutely. And we're talking about one of the things that's interesting is that some of the more problematic aspects of the show were reported on at the time and people were like, yeah, whatever. Mm. And now people are very much like, oh my God, that sounds like an awful thing happened. And it's fascinating to see that context change. It's fascinating to see the context change of the way this show was written about was extremely unique at the time. And now it kind of feels like every show is covered. It's 55% Lost. People write that way about, the show I write for, Yellow Jackets, is very obviously indebted to Lost. But people write about us in the same way. When I got hired to work on that show, the Reddit figured it out and were like, I think Emily's working on the show. Therefore, this is what we have to go read all her recaps. I just was like, no, please don't do that. But speaking about that context, just as I was working on this book, I switched from being a critic to being someone who makes TV. And that was another perspective shift that happened. So I think this book is very engaged with how our context for Lost has changed personally for both Noel and I, sociopolitically in terms of things like race and gender and contexts we're a little bit more aware of and behind the scenes conversations. And then just culturally, we're such a different world for TV and film watchers, just in terms of if you want to watch a show like Lost now, you can go and read the wiki and there's so much information and so much lore to dive through. And at the time it was kind of just Lost. And it's fascinating to see the seeds of so much of our TV watching culture are in this show.
I guess one more question. I was curious if you you know, given, I guess, the way the books shifted conceptually over time, especially particularly in light of Moe's book, like, are you kind of happier with the way it kind of came out that it you know, or do you miss a version of, is there a version of the book that you kind of missed that you might have originally thought it was going to be? Or
I think so. We had talked about it having a bit more extensive interviews. We were always planning on making it a deeper dive on doing the research and like going into old contemporaneous accounts, because I like doing that shit. I think it's fun. And yet we were like, maybe we'll have some longer interviews with significant cast members or showrunners or something like that. And the book kind of just ended up evolving in a way where we weren't able to do that. And also it wasn't fitting in what the book was becoming. I think what it is now, when I sit down and read it, especially when I'm reading Noel's contributions, some of which, you know, I haven't even looked at until now as I'm doing the copy edits on it, you know, I'm like blown away anew by different ways to see this show. And I think especially the fact that we were able to do some essays about some of the larger questions, whether sociopolitical or cultural, it sort of allowed us to talk to scholars and to fans and to folks whose perspectives helped us see this through a light other than, I mean, let's face it, when people talk about something they worked on, even if they have an axe to grind, they're ultimately kind of like trying to celebrate themselves a little bit. And like, we wanted to talk to people who loved this show and who had thoughts about the show outside that perspective. So for instance, one of the things I'm proudest of is I wrote a chapter about the show's treatment of race, which is, let's just say, odd and problematic and has some issues. And those were brought to bear in Mo Ryan's book. But like, I just talked to a bunch of fans of the show who were watching contemporaneously, but are not white. If you can't tell from the name Emily St. James, I'm extremely white. They showed me like, yeah, this conversation was going on back then. I just was really not tuned into it. And like, I'm really proud of that chapter because I think it ended up being a really great look at, for me personally, at engaging with the fact that the TV show I'm watching is not the TV show you're watching, because we're different people.
So this sounds to me like a book that would be a great companion for some people who have never seen the show and want to dig into it episode by episode, and also a book for fans of the show who want to see it in a new way.
Absolutely. One of the things that we found out when we sold it was this show continues to be popular on streaming sites. So, you know, no matter how many times you've watched it, we like to think our book will offer you a new way to see the show. And if you've never watched it before, you should watch Lost. It's such a fun show. It's such a good time. And you should also buy this book and read it as you watch the show.
All right. Yeah, we should probably mention at this point that by downloading this podcast, you are actually legally obligated to buy the book. It's just the way it works out. Yeah. Sorry.
Absolutely. We gave you a lot of content free at the AV Club, and now it's time to pay up.
Yeah. And like the thing, one of the fun things was both Noel and I recapped this show. I recapped it across a variety of like blogs. And then the last season I did it, Los Angeles Times. And when we went back to grab our old writing and put it in the book to see if that was going to work, it just really didn't. We had to rewrite everything from scratch. Everything I wrote in the book is brand new. As far as I know, everything Noel wrote, except for maybe a couple sentences, is brand new. And it's just like, watching this show and writing about it through a brand new lens really changed everything about it for me. And I think people who liked my work as a TV critic, this is probably the last thing I'll ever write that's a TV work of TV criticism. So there you go. What a pitch.
Yeah. So the book is Lost, Back to the Island. It's coming out on September 17th.
Yeah. Do those pre-orders.
Yeah, you got a little time to pre-order, but it's good.
What's the best way? I know pre-orders are incredibly important. What's the preferred way to pre-order? Is there one?
There isn't really. I think that you know, if you want to support your local bookseller, that's always great. But like, I buy everything at bookshop.org because a little gets kicked back to local stores. They say, I'm always skeptical of these things. But like, if you want to order it on Amazon or order it at Barnes and Noble, that's also going to go toward the numbers that help our publisher determine how many sort of books to print and what sort of bestseller lists, if any, we can make it on. It's so much of the publishing industry depends on pre-orders. So if this book sounds interesting to you at all and you have the cash to spend, go buy it any way that you like. Just pre-order it so it shows up on your doorstep on the 17th of September.
Well, thank you for that, Emily. You know, this is normally when we do feedback. We'll be back next time in our next pairing with your thoughts and your recommendations. Of course, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or send us a voice memo or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about Love Lies Bleeding and, like sexy plumbers, dig deep for many, many connections it shares with Bound. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, we hope you can find that special someone you could be in cahoots with.